Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline, will be joining us for the second half of the show. We have two guests today, two poets. Our first guest is Lori Holtz Anderson. And Lori is a New York Times best-selling author whose writing spans young readers, teens, and adults. Combined, her books have sold more than 8 million copies. She's been nominated three times for the Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, and two of her books, Speak and Chains, were National Book Award finalists. She's also been honored for her battles for intellectual freedom by the National Coalition Against Censorship and the National Council of Teachers of English. In addition to combating censorship, Lori regularly speaks about the need for diversity in publishing. She lives in Philadelphia, where she enjoys cheesesteaks while she writes, and Lori's website is madwomaninTheForest.com. The title of the book we're talking today is Shout, and welcome back to Writer's Voices, Lori.
Thank you so much.
So Shout is a memoir, and it's in verse. Is this the first book you've published in those genres?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I took a huge creative leap with this book.
Absolutely. And what made you decide to do that?
Well, you know, this is one of those books that came from my gut, very deep within me. In the fall of 2017, when we were finally beginning to discuss the Me Too movement, let's remember that that was founded in 2006 by Tarana Burke, but some ladies in Hollywood came forward accusing Harvey Weinstein of harming them. And so Me Too finally gained some currency and people were talking about it. So I was listening to a podcast about how some men were really not happy with the fact that women were talking about being survivors of sexual violence. And the misogyny was horrendous. And it made me so, so angry. I was walking down the street in New York City, 11th Avenue, and just lines of poetry started to drop into my head. I was thinking about the thousands and thousands of survivors who have shared their stories with me, and I knew how much pain lay behind those stories, and this book just unfolded, simply unfolded, and I knew I needed to write it, and I knew it needed to be told in verse, not narrative. So I took a deep breath and I took the plunge.
Have you written poetry in the past?
Oh, I've written poetry since second grade. My father was a poet, and so I read a lot of poetry too. The first time I had a poem published was in the 10th anniversary edition of Speak in 2009. And that seemed to be well received, and I wasn't sure how my editor was going to react, number one, or how anybody else was going to react. But I have to say, as a writer, sometimes you need to push yourself a little bit into new territory. And I'm so, so grateful that I tried.
Do you think you'll do it again?
I don't know. I never say never, I guess, is the right. I think it depends on the emotional content of what I'm writing. For me, poetry is either, it's a hug, you know, an embrace, a comfort, or it should carry a punch, like a punch to the gut. And that's what the stories that I'm sharing in Shout do. Some of them are going to make survivors felt very understood and seen. Some of them are going to make anybody who's been silenced for any reason kind of nod in appreciation and understanding. And other times, there are some poems in this book that I think are going to make people gasp a little bit, because there's a lot of people who don't understand yet how much sexual violence the people in our country have had to put up with and how painful it can be. So if the right story calls to me again, I will be happy to pick up my poet's pen.
It's interesting that there are a number of writers working in the young adult space who do write in verse. Ellen Hopkins is one I'm thinking of. She's been our guest a number of times. Are you familiar with her work?
Oh, yeah, she's a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, she's great. And also Jacqueline Woodson.
Jacqueline Woodson, who is our poet laureate, or the ambassador of children's literature in the United States.
Wow. Do you think young adults are maybe more... Now, this book isn't necessarily intended just for young adults, although I'm not sure that any book is anymore.
Well, this is definitely a crossover book, between young adults and not-so-young adults.
Exactly, exactly. But do you think young adults are perhaps more open to reading books, you know, a narrative in poetic form than...
This is what drew... Well, what drew me to writing for teenagers is that they're open to all kinds of artistic expression. If you look at the way that I wrote Speak and the way I wrote the novel Winter Girls, I played a lot with the form. And, I think that we have in children's literature at the YA, the young adult end, the door is open for creativity. And then we have writers like Elizabeth Acevedo. She won the National Book Award last year for her tremendous book, The Poet X. She's a spoken word poet. She travels the world doing spoken poetry. And then she transformed that into a YA novel that's extraordinary. You also have Jason Reynolds and Kwame Alexander. There's just so much excitement. There's so much great art, poetry, verse being created now in YA literature. It's a thrill to be a part of it.
And I think YA literature, even not the poetic, but all of it, is some of the, it is breaking new ground. And it's some of the most interesting and fun to read, too.
I'd like to think that the reason that it's maybe a little bit better, can we say that? A little bit more interesting is that those of us who care so much about teenagers, we know that we have to be at our best, right? We have to up our game because our teenagers, A, are under so much stress, and B, they have so many demands on their time that in order to hold a teen reader, to keep their attention, to keep them engaged, we have to write probably a better quality than books have to be written for adults, because adults are a little bit more patient. Adults will give you a couple of chapters before they say, well, this book's not for me. With teenagers, you have a couple of lines. And if you, right, which is actually a wonderful, wonderful challenge. And it's fun to try to meet that challenge.
Now, in Shout, you talk about your childhood, your own young adulthood, your own episode, or how do you say this, your own experience with sexual violence. Is this the first time that you have revealed that so plainly in print?
Well, I transmuted what I had been through into fiction when I wrote Speak, which came out 20 years ago. Speak is, you know, it's a fictionalization. My attack was different, and how I dealt with it was very different. What I borrowed from my real life was the emotional truth of having something bad happen to you and not knowing how to talk about it or to whom you could talk about it. So those struggles I came through in Speak. But what happened was, shortly after the book came out, I began to receive invitations to talk about the book in high schools. And so I started to speak in front of high school audiences, and those teenagers wanted to know, Miss, did that happen to you? If it happened to you, how did you deal with it? And I realized I had a real responsibility to model being a survivor to teenagers. They are literally dying because they don't have enough adults in their lives that they can trust who are willing to be honest with them about the challenges and the hard things that life can throw at them. So I've been talking about these stories, the same stories that are in Shout. I've been talking about them for 20 years. But in the book, I've finally written everything down to share with everyone.
Was it hard for you to revisit that? Because in order to write these poems that are so powerful, I feel like you must have had to go back and re-experience the emotions of it.
Well, since I have been talking about it with It's not like it's been hidden away from me. You know, I've been talking about it for 20 years. You know, bad things happen to good people all the time. And in my experience, and obviously everyone's experience is quite personal, but since I've been talking about what happened to me, sharing what it felt like, the good choices I made, the bad choices I've made, what this has become is actually kind of a source of strength. I think it's been very healing to me, not only to talk about what I endured when I survived, but then also to move on in my life and to live. I mean, I still have some issues. I still have moments, especially when I'm tired. I still go for therapy every once in a while. Traumatic experiences definitely leave a mark. But one of the smartest and I think the most life-affirming things we can do when we've experienced trauma is to try to live our life based in joy.
Now, when you wrote Speak, that was not the first book that you had written. And I learned that in Shout, where you talk about your early efforts at writing.
I had so many terrible early efforts at writing. Oh my goodness, they were so bad.
So, you know, I think most writers will say you have to write the bad stuff to get to the good. Are there any of those old ones that you would pick out now and say, look, I could rework this and it would be good now?
No, actually, somebody asked me that the other day. I was at a school and someone asked me that. The first publication luck that I had was I published some picture books, and I was writing those when my children were little. And then I wrote a lot of really bad novels that never saw the light of day, thank goodness. And I think it's important when you're starting out or when you're looking back on your career to kind of respect those early pieces. I call them my apprentice pieces. When you're learning a traditional craft, a trade, you work underneath a master, and you're the apprentice. And you make a lot of, you know, if you're a carpenter or a sculptor or whatever, you create a lot of things that are have great intentions, but don't quite hit the mark. But you need to do all of that work in order to improve. It's like, you know, you don't get to be a faster runner unless you actually go out and run, and sometimes you fall down. So I'm really proud of all the really cruddy drafts and all the really not great books that I wrote because they got me to the place where I could create and I could write and communicate effectively. None of the ideas that I had in those early days were interesting enough, I think, to revisit again, though.
Mm. So with Speak, was it just that it took you a while to feel like you could use your own story in a novel?
Well, I think you're giving me too much credit. I really didn't think about it that much. After I was attacked, I didn't tell anybody for 23 years, which is very, very common. And finally, my depression, I had PTSD, and the depression was so overwhelming that I sought therapy, and which I encourage everyone to do if you've been harboring a secret for a long time. And that woman, my therapist, really, really helped me, you know, create my own sense of peace, and I became a much healthier person. And I had a nightmare one night after I had been working with a therapist for a while. And the nightmare was simply a young girl crying in my head. And I thought that, that's kind of an interesting character. I think I'll write about her. And it took me 2 weeks to realize what I was writing about. And honestly, I wrote Speak for myself. I never, ever thought anybody would publish it. I worked on it for a year, went through a lot of different revisions. The first publisher I sent it to rejected it. The second publisher didn't offer me a contract right away because originally the ending was terrible. So she came up with a different ending, and if you could do that, we'll talk. So I rewrote the ending. And then, you know, I had my first novel contract. But still, okay, I sold the book, which I didn't expect to do, And then I didn't think anybody would buy it. And even my publisher didn't think any. They were not hopeful. There was no publicity. They only printed a few thousand copies. And this is a little book that could. I think its success is really a testimony to how many of us are walking around with untended wounds.
So how many copies has Speak sold?
Oh, golly. 3 million, I
think.
Oh,
my goodness.
Right?
Well,
I can't even make sense of it.
Wow. Now, when you went out and started being invited to speak about Speak, you ran into some pushback from adults, and I think you have a poem in here that speaks to that.
I do.
Would you like to share that with us?
Let me see if we can find it fast. It's called Innocence. Yeah, Speak is one of the most censored and banned books in America. And I have thoughts about that. You might not be surprised to find out. But it's also, I have to say, while I'm looking for the poem, the fact that it is it's a standard in curriculum across the country as well. And that has everything to do with the very devoted and compassionate English teachers and librarians who have recognized the needs of the students in their buildings and fought hard to put it in curriculum so we can begin to have responsible conversations about sexual violence and healthy sexuality. So here we go. You ready for a poem?
Yes.
This is called Innocence. Censoring my books in the name of innocence will not build the fence you want. It's not a defense against danger or a stranger, the friend or foe whose hands want to know the feel of your child, your baby girl, or maybe your boy, a toy for their yearning for violence. Depravity, the gravity of which will pull your child into wild denial, her pain untamed by your drugs prescribed, or her drugs street dirty. Nothing can offer relief from the reality that you failed and jailed her happiness in a grave too deep for forgiveness. The false innocence you render for them by censoring truth protects only you.
Thank you. And I know this isn't one that we talked about before, but I would like you to read Librarian on the Cusp of Courage, which is right before Innocence in the book.
Oh, thank you for that opportunity.
Yeah.
This is, on the page, this goes back and forth. So you'll hear kind of two voices, the librarian and me, if you will. Librarian on the Cusp of Courage. I loved your book, says the librarian. Prom, not Speak. I opened my mouth to, of course, I can't have it in my library, she adds. I close my mouth. The main character, she rushes on. I listen. She's disrespectful to authority, cuts class, sleeps their boyfriend. I wait. We can't have those kinds of examples on the shelves. Bingo. And by the end of the book, I ask, well, she touches her crucifix. I wait, thinking of the miles of empty shelves in the hearts of her students. Well, she blinks her dull blue eyes. She does change and grow by the end, and the prom scenes were fun. Exactly the opening I was hoping for. Now we can have a conversation. She drops her eyes to the concrete floor. I can't afford to lose my job. She runs.
It's really kind of amazing that people think that not talking about something makes it go away.
Well, I've really learned something from all these people who've been censoring my work. I've learned that censorship actually has nothing to do with children. Mm. What censoring does is that it protects adults from having conversations that they feel awkward about.
An awkward conversation isn't really so bad compared to...
Exactly. Thank you. Right?
Right.
And what we need... So there's two things I'm trying to do. with this book. Number one, I'm trying to help create a safe, brave space for survivors. Because anybody who's been through any kind of violent situation needs to feel like they are seen. We need to offer support and love and, you know, do what we can do as a culture and a community to help them. But at the same time, we need to be promoting conversations about sexual violence among adults. We need to talk to our girlfriends. We need in our book clubs. This is a great book club book, for the record. In school communities, in faith communities, about the fact that very few of us had parents who were able to talk to us about healthy sexuality, about consent, about the way to interact with another person in a way that's respectful and honorable. And when we can begin to have those conversations as adults, that prepares us to do a better job teaching our children and our grandchildren how to, you know, how to be in a sexual relationship with a person in a way that's responsible, legal, and loving.
Wow. And those topics are so important. I was, you know, when my kids are grown now, and I do have grandchildren, but when my kids were young teens, I was the mom that their friends would talk to.
Yeah.
My own kids didn't want to talk to me necessarily. But they would listen when their friends would ask questions.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I suspect that it's that they knew that, and this is what we want our kids to know. We want our kids to know, that we're there for them. And maybe today's generation of parents has a little bit more work to do, because when you and I were raising our children, they didn't have the access that kids have today to pornography online.
Mm.
The people who are doing, there's research going on about how that's affecting our kids, our grandkids at this point. There's an awful lot of boys in the United States who begin seeing online porn between the ages of 11 and 12,
wow,
which is a horrifying thing to think about. And what they're seeing in pornography, a lot of that is non-consensual sex. And unless they have adults in their lives who can balance that, what they're seeing, with you know, responsible adult conversations about what healthy sexuality is, then you wind up with a lot of kids who don't know how to behave. There are a lot of teenage boys who think that's what's expected of them in sexual situations.
Oh,
so it's on us.
Poor kids.
Right?
Yeah.
I know.
Oh.
It's on us to do a better job.
And, you know, this has been brought out by the Me Too movement, too. Even light romantic comedies and movies that aren't necessarily about romance tend to have characters where the man is pursuing a woman, she says no, and then he keeps pursuing and pursuing and pursuing until she finally says yes and they live happily ever after, which is not really what we want to be happening.
No. And maybe now that we're beginning to accept and celebrate films and television written, produced, directed by women, we'll see a little bit of a change in that, in some of those old tropes.
Yeah.
And we'll see more models of you know, healthy sexuality and interaction. I was at a high school recently, and a high school boy kind of questioned me. He said, "Well, you keep talking about consent, and so you're telling me we're supposed to be having a conversation. Like, I'm supposed to ask her if I can touch her or kiss her?" I said, "Yeah, actually, you are. And she's supposed to ask you, too. And that conversation in itself can be quite delightful." And he said, "But in the movies, everything just flows." I said, "Yeah, that's a movie. That's not real life." So, and the puzzled look on his face just, right?
Yeah.
So, again, over and over, we see the need for the adults in the room to actually act like adults. And that means to provide leadership.
Well, Laurie, before we run out of time, let's hear one more poem from Shout.
Okay. Alrighty.
And I think Diagnosis on page 68.
That would be a great one to end on.
Awesome.
Okay. This is a poem about what it felt like in the years after I was attacked. Diagnosis. I knew that if I fell and scraped my knee, ejected headfirst through a windshield, chopped off a finger or lost a leg to a shark, I'd apply pressure to stop the bleeding, use towels, blankets, Goodwill sweaters, whatever it took to start clotting, slow the fluid loss. I'd close my wounds with fishhooks and twine, or a stapler, or a nail gun, welding torch to reconnect my spine. I'd knit skin grafts if necessary. After I pulled myself back together, I'd need a doctor, because my dark corners would be invaded by bacteria, viruses, parasites, and more. Infectious vectors of disease, some lethal, some merely debilitating, chronic cripplers. I knew that. I paid attention in health. But I had never seen a first aid kit for the spirit or heard the word trauma to describe the way I'd hide, slide through the days unseen, or scream into the pillows at the bottom of my closet, door closed even though no one was home. Rape wounds deeply. Splits open your core with shrapnel. The stench of the injury attracts maggots which hatch into clouds of doubt and self-loathing. The dirt you feel inside you nourishes anxiety, depression, and shame, poisoning your blood, festering in your brain until you will do anything to stop feeling the darkness rising within. Anything to stop feeling. Untreated pain is a cancer of the soul that can kill you.
And that was Laurie Holtz Anderson reading from Shout. And I know how to pronounce your middle name because of one of your poems.
I like that.
It's like, I won't forget it anymore.
Yay.
Yay. So what's next for you?
Well, my next project is actually done, I'm happy to report. Next year, I'm bringing out a graphic novel about Wonder Woman.
Oh, very cool.
Oh my gosh, it was so much. My last two projects have been writing way outside of what I'm traditionally known for. And as a creative person, I really encourage other people to consider doing that. It refreshes everything and kind of helps you see the world again with new eyes. So I'm excited about that.
That sounds really fun, and I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here today.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and please stay with us as we welcome my mother, Caroline Kilbourne, to the show, and our second guest, Doug Hoekstra.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Writers' Voices. We have a very interesting author today, also a musician, and I think you're going to enjoy this.
And a poet.
Oh, yes.
Tell us, his name is Doug Hoekstra, and his poetry collection is titled Unopened. Mom, you want to tell us a little bit about Doug?
Well, first of all, this book should definitely be opened. But Doug is a Chicago-bred, Nashville-based writer and musician, educated at DePaul University with a B.A., and Belmont University. His first book, Bothering the Coffee Drinkers, Canopic Publishing, in April of 2016, was an Independent Publisher Award bronze medal finalist for best short fiction. And I would like to get that. I think it'd be interesting to read. So he's multi-talented, and as I said, this book is very, this collection of poetry is very interesting, and I think anyone would enjoy it. So
welcome to Writers' Voices, Doug.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks.
So what's the difference between writing lyrics, which you've done an awfully lot of, and writing poetry?
That's a good question. You know, it's funny. I mean, when I, as a songwriter, I generally write lyrics first because I get ideas for songs, and then the sort of the lyrical content will suggest a musical backdrop, you know? And so then I'll wind up slicing and dicing and cutting a lot. I mean, you know, cutting lyrics or obviously you usually try to rhyme, you know, to fit the musical context. And sometimes, you know, I'll be with guitar or piano in hand, so the two will kind of go together. And so even though a lot of my stuff is narrative musically, it still is sort of in that combination. And I think the difference with doing prose or poetry is that you're freed from that, and you're sort of there's still a structure. You know, even in free verse, there's a rhythm, and I think I'm real cognizant of the rhythm of the words because of my music background. But at the same time, I think you still have a little more leeway in terms of where it heads because you're not trying to, the music is sort of implied. It's sort of in maybe in the reader's head. So I think that would be the main difference. But I mean, I think anything is fair game for context and content and topics in either form. They're just really responding to things around you.
Well, when you get an idea and you start working on a piece, do you know immediately this is a song or this is a poem or this is an essay or
Not always. I mean, I think anything can be anything. A lot of times it depends on kind of what I'm writing at that time. Like when I was in the midst of, you know, the book, the poetry book started with kind of a core collection of poems. And really, I kind of thought about it originally as something just to give my son, you know, and for him to have. But then it started to take form, and it had these three sections and everything else. And then I started writing to that, and I started to think in those ideas. And at that time, I would write mostly poetry because I was trying to finish the book, you know. So sometimes it's exactly what you're in the mode of at that moment. And I think it's good to get away from forms. Like after I was done with it, and I started writing a bunch of songs again, and now I'm in the midst of that, and so things seem to be shoveling into that form. I mean, sometimes topics will arise in all these different forms, whether it be essay or fiction or songs or poetry, and maybe there'll be just little different shades of them because of the forms that you work with. So, I mean, I try to think of it mindfully, but then I try not to think of it too much either. I mean, it's sort of that balance, you know, because you don't want to be self-conscious, and you want to have some magic in the process. So,
Well, I could have related to, since I play the piano and guitar, I could relate to how some of these poems could be set to music because they had
yeah,
that.
and who knows? I mean, there was a couple poems, honestly, not in this book, but I've written since, where as I worked on this batch of tunes, I went back to one of these poems. It was in a journal, and I sliced it and diced it and redid it for music. I mean, you know, and sometimes it just gives you a different context. Like, I mean, you know, Springsteen writes about this a lot, how for him and his music, his verses are sort of the narrative, and then the choruses are sort of a parallel world or something where the audience comes in. I think that's a good way to look at it. And I think sometimes when you go into that form, then you start expressing these different ideas. So, I mean, it's just different, but it's all cool, you know. I think it's just about trying to connect with your audience and really just trying to give the subject its due, ultimately.
And of course, with poetry, there's a lot of different forms, and you're covering quite a few of them in here, aren't you?
Yeah, I tried to because, you know, I think it's nowadays everybody's a poet, you know, and I guess we all are poets because we're all artists, really, in the way we live. But at the same time, I think there's a, it's funny how the, you know, I mean, I did get a bachelor and a master's, and they've got literature context, so I studied a lot of poetry. And it's funny how poetry went from, you know, more structured in these forms like sonnets and you know, certain rhyme schemes and things like that to almost all free verse now, you know? I mean, there's such an emphasis on free verse. And so when I was putting the book together, I didn't want it just to be that. I mean, I think the poems are structured even when they're free verse, but yeah, there's some Sudokas in there, and there's a sonnet, and there's some other things like that, because I just wanted to have that variety, and I wanted, and plus it makes it interesting as a writer, because when you work in certain forms, then it forces you to think differently. And I think that's one of the values of it, is to see if you can, you know, what kind of different ideas. I mean, I taught writing for a while here in Nashville, and I would always do sort of prompts and free writes and things like that for my students, even though it wasn't strictly a creative writing class. And part of my rationale to them was, look, if you're given this certain layout or this certain context, then you're going to think differently, you know, and then it's going to put your ideas in different places than you normally would. And so, you know, I think it's good to try to force ourselves to do that. And I guess that's one of the differences, circling back to your original question, between doing songs and essays and fiction. It just forces you to look at things differently in these different ways.
What is a Sudoku?
It's a Eastern thing. It's like the haiku, but it's different. I should be able to tell you off the top of my head, but it's something like 557577, something like that. And I stumbled across a book by this poet called Ryokan, Ryokan, and he was like a, you know, Zen poet in the, I don't know, 11th century. I'm probably getting half this wrong, but I was very impressed, because it was like haiku, but it was a little more involved. And he, you know, I like that kind of idea, because I like the idea of the minimalism, and I like the idea of, you know, in music, for instance, a lot of things live between the notes, right? There's the notes, but there's between the notes. It's dynamics. It's essential. And it's the same thing in writing. And so when you work in a really short, tight form like that, the same deal. It forces you to both conform to that, but then also let a lot of air in. And I think when that happens, then ideally the reader has their experience in that space. So anyway, that's what inspired me to write those. And I did give that exercise to my students too. I would say, hey, do these. And they all got into it. You know, they all got into that challenge.
Well, I remember as a kid, I loved writing haiku.
I can still
like remember the way it made me feel.
Yeah, and I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think it's a little misunderstood, because, again, so much haiku is done, and a lot of these things are done, and people can dash them off. And you can, but at the same time, if you really think about it, if you really think about what you're doing, then every word counts, you know, and no other word will fit in that space. And, you know, I mean, it's the reason the Zen monks did is because it's a mindfulness thing. It's hand in hand with that. It makes you be mindful to the experience and the content and the and every word. So yeah, I really like that. I mean, with haiku, same. And any kind of formalized structure will make you do that. I mean, some people would say blues music does that. I mean, Langston Hughes wrote a bunch of poems that were based on blues forms, because he felt that with blues. He felt that was the version of that. And so I think those things are deceptive, because I think people can underestimate the effort and the impact of what comes out of those short, tight forms.
You know, I'm jotting down some of these things that you're saying, because we always pull a quote out of the interviews, and I've got so many already that would make our great quote for your interview.
Well, thank you.
Well, I enjoy poetry that tell a story, and a lot of your poems do. And that's, you know, it's great, because in a few words you can tell a story, set a scene, tell a story, and it, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's very refreshing to me.
Well, thank you.
Well, why don't we hear a few of these poems?
Yes, please.
Sure. All right, let me, I was just going to go grab my Sudoku book here to make sure I'm not messing that up, but you can fact check me on that later.
Okay.
And the poems
okay.
are in the book, so.
Awesome.
All right, so we talked about, before we started, one thing I tried to do with the book is carve it up into sections. And so we've got like a book section, like part one called On the Page, which is like close to family poems and things like that, things close to home. And part two is Off the Canvas, which is more like not necessarily political, but societal, political, those sorts of things. And then part three, Between the Notes, which is, you know, music, art, love, and indefinable places. And I wanted to do that because there seemed to be kind of a natural way the poems were falling into place. And plus, I just didn't want to be like a dude with a bunch of poems, you know? I wanted to have some kind of purpose.
Right.
And so I figured that would be a good thing, too, because, you know, it's a short attention span world in some ways, but you know, I'm okay with people, like, ideally picking up the book and maybe gravitating to a section at one time and then putting it down and coming back later to another. So I figured that would be a good way to define it. And one of the poems that you mentioned before we started is from the first section. It's called The Teeter Board. So I'll read that right now. The Teeter Board. Walking by the playground where my son used to play. On endless afternoons, sliding, bucket on his head, pretending he was the Artful Dodger, running a hand across the dragon, I noticed. Two children on a seesaw or teeter-totter, a long, narrow board with a pivot point or sweet spot in the middle. A boy and a girl were laughing as one went up and the other went down. They bounced and balanced perfectly, power dynamic, shattered, equanimity, sun dipping behind the clouds. I took another trip around the sun, sat on a bench and wondered what happens. On the way to adulthood and the bedroom and the boardroom and the war room where everyone wants their own and the sweet spot is lost.
Yeah.
Ta-da!
There's a lot in that poem.
Wow, thank you.
Sure.
So, yeah, so that was the, let's see, on the page. And then the
right.
next section is Off the Canvas, Out into the World.
Yes.
Yeah.
And do you want me to read one from there that we talked about here?
Please.
Go forward. Yeah, the claims approver. Okay. There's some, like, work poems and things like that in this section, and this is one of them. It's called The Claims Approver. From behind a tiny desk in a dusty office on the 15th floor of a massive structure set in stone on a city block built before his birth, he paid 25,000 claims. 25,000 claims in a single year. Hypertension, vaginitis, gangrene, gout, rabies, scabies, and cancer of the pancreas. Pulmonary arteries hardening again. Ptosis, thrombosis, and abdominal pain. He paid 25,000 claims. 25,000 claims in a single year. From behind his Coke bottle glasses and furrowed brow, he doubled his production and hung a picture of his dog and waited for his supervisor and the simple word of thanks that never came. He paid 25,000 claims.
Yeah, I love that. That depicts so many people in this world.
Now, that's one that I also kind of have a parallel version. I kind of pulled from it for a song that was on one of my records, actually called Where I Worked. And it was a little more, it just got into different parts of the character. Honestly, and was able to kind of it's a different perspective. It's more about the relationship with the protagonist than the person. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you can do that and just kind of like mine different territory.
I'm very curious. Did you work as a claims adjuster?
For a little while, yeah. I mean, I was when I was getting my degree at DePaul, I had this job doing that, you know, part-time. And boy, it's tedious, let me tell you. I don't even know if they do it anymore because, you know, everything's so automated, you
right,
know?
Right.
And there was a fellow like that, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of liberties in this, but he was so driven on paying more claims than anybody. And it's just like, it's sort of like factory work, really. It would be like saying I made 25,000 widgets, you know?
Is it possible to actually pay 25,000 claims? It sounds like a lot.
You know, I don't remember, but I think he did. I think he did. I mean, you can imagine. It's like day in and day out. And he took the train in. It was in Chicago, and he lived in the suburbs, and he took the train in, and he was a big Cubs fan, and he really lived for his Cubs and his dog and his claims. And so I thought that was interesting.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Doug Hoekstra, author of Unopened, which is his debut poetry collection, and it is a finalist in the, let's see, IPPY. What does that stand for?
Well, I was a finalist. I don't know if this is a finalist. I was a finalist for my fiction.
Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
And that's the Independent
Publisher Award. Yeah.
Okay,
Bothering
cool.
the Coffee Drinkers was an IPPY finalist. Now, this is nominated, but I have no idea where I'm at, so I don't want to jinx it.
Okay. Now, the title, Unopened, what does that mean mm-hmm. for you?
Well, you know, there's this signature poem in the book, and this is based on a true story. When my parents were, you know, they've since passed, but I was downstairs. My dad was kind of a collector, and he had all these records downstairs, and I was going through them because he didn't want to keep them all, and I found this record that was unopened, that was sealed. That he had bought, probably, like, he used to like to go on his lunch hour and like go to Rose Records and Rolling Stone Records and those places that used to be in the Loop in Chicago. And this record was still sealed and had the tag on it and everything. And I saw it and I thought, you know, I mean, here he was just going on his lunch hour to do a little treat for himself and bought this record and he shelved it and never listened to it, right? And I thought that was kind of poignant. And then I thought, well, that's a good title for a book, and this book, because it's about that. It's about experiences that are sort of unopened, you know, and what happens when you really open them up and look at them and, you know, hold those experiences and think about them and think about the emotions they give you and think about the world in a different way. I mean, kind of all art does that, you know. It kind of forces you to unopen your life and your thoughts. So I thought that would be a good title, really. And then it's literal as well, in that, you know, people, you know, will open up the book. And the book has some collage on the cover, which I did, and part of one of the pieces of the collage is that album where I took pictures of it and cut it up and reassembled it. And so I thought that's kind of like how memory works too. You know, you kind of like cut up your memories and reassemble them in a way that's both reflective and not reflective of how they really were. So
the third section is titled Between the Notes.
Right.
And you want to share a poem from that section with us?
Sure, yeah. This one's called Vinyl, which we mentioned again before we started. And, well, it speaks for itself, so here we go. It's called Vinyl. Lately I've been listening to old records, guilty pleasures, lovingly encased in plastic, stored away in dusty places I never thought I'd visit again. Unwittingly, the needle drops, bringing back moments, painted and cast, anticipated nights, long drives long forgotten, girls and worlds to be touched again. It's funny how a chord or a melody that lingers brings you back in time, effortlessly. Moon River, Wichita Lineman, songs I didn't even know I liked, can make me cry, even when they skip. Nostalgia fades away, but I still can't understand the boy who was standing in the mirror so many years ago.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
A lot of people can relate to that poem.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the same kind of thing. I mean, there's a few poems in the book where, you know, it borders on nostalgia, but I didn't really want to go to that place of nostalgia. And to me, the difference is, again, kind of examining that. And, you know, what did Faulkner say? The past is never past, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these past things inform us now. I mean, it's all, to get back to the Zen thing again, it's really about the moment. And sometimes those things from the past are the moment, you know? And time is funny that way. And I think certainly with music in this case, you know, that resonance, you think of those days, but you also, it brings you to the present. I mean, I mean, Wichita Lineman, that song's like a hymn, right? And so you can hear that, and it can bring you to that moment you heard it first, yes, but it also brings you to the feeling of that moment now. And it's about layers, really, to me. So, I mean, I tried to be careful not to be nostalgic in a traditional sense. To me, nostalgia is sort of about romanticizing the past, and these pieces, to me, try to repurpose the past, if that makes sense, in a way that's the present.
So, Doug, I noticed that the name of the publishing company is 5 Minute Books.
Yes.
And there's a reference to, you know, songwriting being kind of 5 Minute worlds. So is that where that name came from?
Yep.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, anybody who says they don't read the reviews of their stuff is a liar. You know, everybody does. And one of my favorite music reviews came out of Wired Music, and it was a guy who got into my stuff and wrote about me a lot of different stuff. His name's Philip Van Black, and he later became a friend because that's how we got to know each other. And he wrote a review that said, a lot of people write songs, Hoekstra writes 5 Minute Worlds. And I thought that was great. I thought that was really, you know, again, going back to what we talked about with haiku and Zen, I mean, that's like a great, I mean, it's great to get a nice, to get praise on your work, but it's really great when people say something that you feel really encapsulates what you're trying to do. Because then you know that you connected, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, that's always stayed with me, and I've recycled that a bajillion times. And yeah, and that still kind of, to me, also works with these poems. You know, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to give people 5 Minute Worlds.
Yep, exactly. And poetry is a really powerful way to do that, more than prose, I think.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's the minimalism. Somebody was asking me about that not too long ago, and I think it's just that. I think it's, you know, it's the idea of space. It's the idea of that space allows your audience in. I mean, to me, that's the thing. I don't like stuff that kind of like tries to manipulate the audience to an emotional place. I think if you write with a direction and a narrative, in this case, that's great, but you have to be sure to know that it's not just you, that it's those spaces that people can get into, and then it makes it worth doing, really.
Now, Doug, do you sit down and write something every day, or do you wait
No.
for inspiration?
Well, neither. I wish I was the guy who, I think people who write every, I mean, if you sit down, like people who work on novels and write, like, you know, 2 hours every morning or whatever, that's terrific, and I believe in that. But, you know, I have a son, and I have other ways to make money, and, you know, I work nonprofit, and I do other things, and it's difficult to do that. But I do think that I probably do something every day creatively, if that makes sense. And to me, the whole thing is about, you know, maybe it'll be writing down an idea, maybe it'll be working on a piece, you know, an essay that I have going, or maybe it'll be like working on some music or whatever. I do think I do something every day, and I think that keeps everything fresh. And I also feel like I've been fortunate, and I've never really had writer's block because I just think there's so much to write about that I probably don't have time to address it all. And once I get rolling on a set of things or a piece, then it gravitates to other ideas. And that, to me, is the greatest benefit of doing something every day, because when you're constantly keeping that creative part of your mind open and flowing, you know. So I do that in some form. I guess it's just not directed to a particular time or a particular set quantity, you know, like an hour a day or whatever. But there's
Right,
always
right.
something percolating. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I believe we're about out of time, and we want to thank you so much for being with us today and sharing the poems from Unopened,
Sure.
which,
Yeah, thanks for having me
of
again.
course, and Unopened is available, I'm assuming, on Amazon.
It is, and some fine bookstores, and you can always Google and find my website, which is my WordPress site. It's just my name at WordPress, and there's a bunch of links to other things, and yeah, and there's books and music on Amazon and all that good stuff. So by all means, check it out if you're interested. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's Doug Hoekstra, HOEKSTRA.wordpress.com.
Yes.
Yeah. And Mom, do you have some closing words?
I do. You know, we can't change the past, but it really doesn't hurt to visit it sometimes.
True.
True. Thank you, and see you all next time on Writers' Voices.
Bye now.
Thanks.